Amory and WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Idalia continues to strengthen as it moves closer to Florida's Gulf Coast, packing 105-mile-an-hour winds. Governor Ron DeSantis says anyone in an evacuation zone needs to leave now.
The National Hurricane Center advisory includes that if this storm hits at high tide, storm surge could reach 10 to 15 feet in some areas of the Big Bend.
Forecasters expect landfall tomorrow, but the outer bands are already sweeping across Florida. President Biden announcing the first 10 drugs that Medicare will negotiate prices with drug companies.
Instead of using all your energy to fight the disease, you're fighting insurance or drug companies for medicines that literally keep you alive. Without them, you're not going to be here.
Those companies are fighting in court. A brother and sister shot and killed in front of a courthouse in Puerto Rico. Police say the shooter was arrested minutes later. This is ABC News. They are expecting critical fire conditions in Northern California through tomorrow. Pacific Gas and Electric warns they might have to potentially shut off power starting at 3 a.m. Wednesday in eight counties to avoid starting wildfires. Now the question, will 19 defendants be tried together in the Georgia election interference case?
The Fulton County DA still hopes to have all 19 co-defendants tried together in the same courtroom, but at least two have now demanded a speedy trial, and former President Trump has not. He's seeking to sever his case from the others to avoid a rush to trial. In a new court filing, DA Fani Willis says separating the cases would be improper at this juncture, and she reiterates her request that all 19 co-defendants be tried together. A federal judge is still weighing former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' request to move his case into federal court.
ABC's Stephen Portnoy. Under a new policy, companies filling out marriage certificates in Boston will no longer be required to identify their sex or gender. Andy Field, ABC News.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Microsoft has officially started construction on a $1 billion data center development in Racine County, Wisconsin. The facility should be completed by 2026, and it will occupy 215 acres at the intersection of 90th Street and Highway KR. The location of the data center is also in close proximity to a Foxconn LCD project that was proposed but never followed through on, and Microsoft bought the land for $50 million, some of which will be used to reimburse Foxconn for releasing the rights to the land. Wisconsin's Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee rejected a proposal by the Department of Public Instruction last week, which would have included private schools in an online dashboard regarding school district finances. According to WPR, the Wisconsin Coalition for Educational Freedom objected to private school spending being included, following the state budget's largest financial expansion to private school choice in the program's history. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. This includes a commitment to news. Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, big Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Alba Show, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Alba Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
To cut local air pollution and emissions, and officials say they're cheaper to operate. And finally, in Ecuador, in a historic national referendum, Ecuadorians voted overwhelmingly to ban oil drilling in Yasuni National Park in the Amazon rainforest, one of the most diverse biospheres in the world. It's hailed as a historic example of climate democracy, and it was also a victory for indigenous peoples and conservationists.
I will share that hailing. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we talked on the show yesterday, kind of a big freaking deal going on at the NLRB. This CMEX decision, this announcement, kind of a big deal. Going back to what built the labor movement of my grandparents' generation. You know, I remember them telling me the stories of, look, they march on the boss and said, we've got enough people who want recognition. We demand recognition. We're going to start bargaining. There was no long-term elections. There was no, high-priced law firms coming to harass and intimidate. There were no firings. There was none of that. And if workers didn't get what they want, they shut things down. And you go, well, can we do that again? I don't know whether we're that society, but we could be. And that's why I'm thrilled to see my next guest's article over at the American Prospect. Biden's NLRB brings workers' rights back from the dead, written by the incredible Harold Meyerson, who is the editor-at-large there at the American Prospect. Harold, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to be here, Rick.
So let's start here. How big of a deal is this?
I would say, like you said, it's a big effing deal. This is probably the most important NLRB ruling in about 70 years, because it takes workers' rights back to that period when workers' rights were real and hadn't yet been eroded by bad court decisions and mistakes of earlier NLRB boards. It's a big deal. It could lead to the most serious organizing campaigns we've seen in a very, very long time, and because they have a better chance of winning.
I mean, over the last 70, 80 years, it's been the death of 1,000 paper cuts for the NLRA. This isn't undoing all of that, but this is one of the few times where I think we're going in the right direction.
Yeah, well, the NLRB has a general counsel named Jennifer Abruzzo, who has spent most of her life, coming up in the ranks of the NLRB with detours with during Republican administrations to the communication workers and some other unions. And she kind of set a mission as soon as she became the general counsel, telling the 500 NLRB workers who work for the general counsel that, you know, I want you to start citing some labor standards that once, you know, once prevailed, and we're going to get them back. And there was a decision. She put argued a case, as the general counsel does, before the NLRB. And on Friday, the NLRB, I think, delivered really a historic landmark decision.
Now, what does this decision say? What's the...
It says basically this, that if a majority of workers want a union, you know, through signing cards, affiliation cards, or what have you, the employer can do one of two things. He can either recognize the union, which, of course, never happens voluntarily, or he's obligated to immediately file for a board election. Then part two of the decision, which is really the, you know, the wowzer, says if the employer commits an unfair labor practice in the run-up to the election or during the election, the union is automatically recognized and the employer is ordered to immediately go into bargaining with the workers. That's close to what the standard was up until 1969, when in a Supreme Court decision that was based on a member of the Richard Nixon's NLRB who misstated the board's position, when that was scrapped. But it basically assumed that the board's position was no longer that.
Right.
That the employer couldn't be ordered to recognize the union and get into bargaining. This new NLRB ruling says, yes, there's an unfair labor practice, like firing a worker who's involved in the unionization campaign, which is a very, very common occurrence in modern American labor relations and has been for 40 years, but now the board can order that employer to immediately recognize a union and enter into bargaining.
Right, and this is what
that
I said.
That is a big deal. One other thing that I didn't write in the article, but it's occurred to me since. Because unionizing workers became so much more difficult, a lot of unions just kind of gave up. And I remember when John Sweeney ran against the old George Meany, Lane Kirkland regime at the AFL-CIO, he had a study done which showed that unions on the whole spent about 3% of their budgets on organizing. And the reason it was 3% was that after several decades in which, you know, the right to unionize had effectively been negated, they gave up. And the board ruling creates a situation where they can now, I think, gear up and really indeed start organizing.
No, and this goes back to, and I talk about this all the time, because I was fortunate enough to be around a lot of older workers when I started, and they told me the stories of the 50s and the 60s and the fights to organize workplaces and how they did it. And they would have never tolerated the kind of abuses that we tolerate now. And we've become accustomed to. Look, firing someone during an organizing campaign is standard practice. And if you're one of these union busting law firms advising these companies, it's almost malpractice not to tell them to fire someone, because there's a massive chilling effect across the organized body, and there's no penalty. Oh, maybe you have to post the dreaded notice to promise to never do it again,
right,
until you do it the next time.
Right. And it's the most commonly violated law in the United States, because, again, as you just said, there is no effective penalty. Now, you know, there's a new sheriff in town.
Do you think this could move us? Because, you know, I argue that my grandparents' generation were a different breed. They came home from fighting World War II and fascism overseas, and they went to the shop floor to build the most prosperous working class in history. And they did that through organizing. But the laws were better on their sides than they are now. Do you see this as the potential of maybe moving society back into that direction where even if you weren't a union member, you were still supportive?
Yeah, you know, Rick, I think society is moving in that direction, but the law has been blocking it. We've been seeing every Labor Day, the approval rating among the public for unions has been getting up to like 70%. And just today being Wednesday, Tuesday. Okay. The AFL-CIO released a poll of its own on union approval ratings, which again was in the 70 percentiles. But what struck me was that among Americans who were between the ages of 18 and 29, the union approval rating was 88%. And, you know, I asked the NLRB some time ago for all the votes when all the teaching assistants and research assistants at universities have been voting on whether to form unions. And I added them all up and figured out the percentage. It was 89%. And the poll today said, 18 to 29-year-olds, it's 88%. So this is Generation Union. They know that the economy isn't working for them. They would suffered, you know, the brunt of the very, very, very slow recovery from the 2008, Wall Street panic. And I think the society is ready for this. And for the first time in 70 years, they just got a green light from the NLRB that says, okay, go ahead.
No, this is a big deal. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Harold Meyerson. Harold is the editor-at-large at The American Prospect. You can check out their website, prospect.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at his most recent piece, Biden's NLRB Brings Workers' Rights Back from the Dead. And I got to tell you, I am thrilled with the Biden administration. I'm thrilled with Jelly Bucket Joe doing the work because, look, I've lived through the Carter years when we were supposed to get rid of Taft-Hartley. I lived through the Clinton years where we were talking about strengthening labor rights in these bad trade agreements and, you know, having strike replacement bills that got filibustered. Obama, I shook his hand twice. He told me we're getting something better than the Employee Free Choice Act and continually come up with nothing. This to me is huge. It's tangible, and it's something that's about darn time.
Absolutely. No, I mean, and when Biden says he's the most pro-union president, I'd say he's the most pro-union president in American history. And he's still got to do more. I mean, there's a whole question of, you know, going to the green economy, how much pressure he can put on companies to make sure that those are union workers and all the new factories that are now beginning to spring up. But he's made some pretty damn good appointments, including at the NLRB, very definitely. And he is committed, in part, he's sort of close to your grandparents' generation. The downside of his age is a political handicap. The upside is he actually remembers a unionized America when there was more of a middle class than there is now. And he's doing a lot to try to get it back.
No, and that's a great thing. And it's something I fully 100% support. But again, I come back to that societal thing that I think is so important. And I think you're right. I think the younger generation, having watched their parents get chewed up and spit out with this economy and watching jobs being offshored and communities broken, want to take some control of the economy, and I think that is a really good thing. But here's my problem, and I know I'm pitching this as, you know, this is a great thing, and you've got it as, you know, we're bringing rights back from the dead. There's a flaw here, though, because you can have union recognition all you want. If it doesn't come down to a contract, if you don't get that book that makes lives better with the wages, hours, conditions all written in it, not much there. Thoughts?
You're absolutely right. Now, the last couple labor law reform bills, which never made it through the Senate, had language in them which said, well, if, you know, there's no contract after whatever it was, 90 days, 180 days, then the government arbitrator will come in and impose a contract, which is, you know, then you put the fear of God into employers who routinely stonewall workers. I mean, you know, that they've done nothing with the 300 or so Starbucks outlets that have gone union, or they've done nothing with the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, which has gone union. It's not really clear that the board has a legal authority to mandate that kind of arbitration. That may require, again, a labor law reform bill that under some peculiar circumstance finally manages to pass. So that is still a real obstacle. And you're right, Rick, it is a problem. It is a real existing problem right now.
Yeah, but I see this as an opportunity, Harold. This is where the politics of this is so important. You know, I talk to all my union brothers and sisters and say, look, you know, the reason you vote for Joe Biden is this. This is something that is going to make workers' lives better. It's going to make union families' lives better. It's going to expand our ability to increase density, which is going to raise wages and conditions and lots of snowball effect of good stuff. This is where the politics matter, because we're one administration away from all of this just being wiped away, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, to a lot of people who may be reluctant to vote for Biden, this is a hell of a good case, you know, that this guy's appointees have really delivered, that he's committed. And, you know, the only way we're ever going to recreate a middle class here and more broadly shared prosperity is to go down this route. And he's gone farther down that route than any president, you know, maybe since FDR.
Yeah, I'm excited about this. It's going to be good opportunities. You said a second ago, and this is kind of the last line of questioning I have then. You said a second ago that the unions had kind of stopped organizing. Do you see now that changing and, you know, things being kind of hypercharged? Do you see new unions that may not have spent a lot of time and energy, you know, trying to organize new places, maybe going in that direction?
I do. I mean, the Teamsters already have done a pretty impressive job. And I always thought that there were parts of the contract they won at UPS that would help them with Amazon, like, you know, stopping the camera pointed at the UPS driver, because what workers in America have their every motion, you know, recorded by management? It's Amazon warehouse workers. So, you know, I think they've been trying to tee that up. But yeah, I think that, you know, the new leadership at the UAW looking at all these southern transplant factories and the new battery EV factories that are springing up. Yeah, now, you know, all of, you know, the UAW has gotten nowhere in the South with factories for a very long time. But, you know, the companies that have those factories have been using unfair labor practices up the wazoo routinely every day. Now they can't do that. So, yeah, I really foresee an increase in organizing in a lot of unions. I can think of 10, maybe 12 unions that will be gearing up. I hope I'm right. I mean, I could be wrong, but, you know, this is the first time it's really rational for them to spend a lot more than they've been spending up to now on organizing campaigns.
No, absolutely. Harold, I appreciate the time. Great article. Hope folks will take a look at it. Biden's NLRB brings workers' rights back from the dead. Written by Harold Meyerson, editor at large there at the American Prospect. Prospect.org, the website. Harold, thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
It's great to be here, Rick. Thank you.
I want to hear your thoughts. Are you as optimistic? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I can't emphasize enough how important politically this issue is. You know, 2024, if you're a working person, this is what you're voting for. It's these policies that are going to help recreate that prosperous working class that our grandparents' generation built. And as I've been saying, look, and maybe I'm a little hung up on the societal push, but I remember the stories from the old timers, you know, who were talking about the sit-down strikes, which, by the way, were illegal. And the politicians who could have sent in the National Guard and had them beaten, you know, like they did back in the teens in Chicago, or I mean in Colorado during the coal field wars. You had governors who were sending in the militia and the state police that was, you know, basically created to break these strikes. You had politicians during the 30s going, we're not going to do it. Figure it out. The greatest thing that Roosevelt ever did was nothing. He didn't send in the military. He said, we passed a law, figure it out, bargain it out, hammer it out. And when those workers sat down in Michigan, the governor didn't send in the National Guard. He said, figure it out. And that led to an explosion in what we now call the middle class. I call it a prosperous working class. And that generation was a little different. I mean, I think my grandparents, and I've told this story a bunch of times in the past, and it's worth repeating. After my mother passed and I moved in with my grandparents, there was somebody who lived in the house catty corner from my grandparents, and my grandfather was very clear. You do not go over to that house. You don't play with his grandkids. You don't look at you don't deliver a newspaper over there. And, you know, it was one of those things I didn't question. And like 10 years later, you know, probably 15, actually, I said, you know, what was that about? You know, why was that so important? And turns out the guy crossed a railroad picket like, you know, 30 years earlier. And it wasn't just my grandfather. It was everybody who had ostracized this guy. He was a scab and society held him accountable so that nobody else did it. And that's what I'm talking about it being societal. I mean, they came back from World War II and said, look, we're not taking it anymore. We're not going back. And I look at this moment, I'm not comparing COVID to World War II, but that kind of, hey, we're somebody now. Hey, you needed us. Hey, we were important. We're not going back to being nobody. We're not going back to starving. We're not going back to being hungry and homeless and desperate and destitute. We're not doing it. We're going to fight for better, for ourselves, for our children, for the future. That was the mantra. And coming out of the pandemic, same kind of thing, same vibe. You know, we're frontline heroes. We're essential. You know, we're good enough to show up while it's dangerous and you know, bring you your packages, but not good enough to make a living wage. Not good enough to have health care for our kids. Not good enough to have some retirement security for ourselves down the road. This is one of those moments. And I can't emphasize enough politically how important this is. Because understand, if Trump is elected, all this goes away. And we return back to the good old days of it being political legal malpractice almost to not fire workers. Now, look, I've done organizing in the past. I've seen what happens to morale in a workforce where the boss fires the top two most ardent supporters, and in a very public way, and for nonsense. And they know they're going to eventually have to hire them back. They know eventually they're going to be found, to have broken the law, but they don't care because the penalties are pathetic. You fire somebody and they go get another job making the same money or more money than they were making working for you. It's a wash. It doesn't cost you anything. Because they know most working people can't last 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years to fight through the process without going and getting a job. So it means that their liability is less. Which is why the Employee Free Choice Act tripled that number. That was one of the tenets of the Employee Free Choice Act, where if you fire someone illegally, you pay that person a penalty triple to the salary that they would have earned. So even if they did make the same money, there's still a penalty. Now, nobody believed that was going to be the great stopper of this, but it was something to consider. We don't even have that. This is where, for me, it comes back down to society and this being a voting issue. This being an incredibly important voting issue. Because wages, hours, conditions, those are important. But it does bring us back to my original question. Which are you first? Are you a working person? Are you a worker? Or are you a consumer? Where is your allegiance? Where are your values? Where? What's more important? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Maybe I could be off on this. You know, and I want to hear, if you think I'm wrong, and you think this is bad, by all means, enlighten us. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day that became known for the Quebec Bridge disaster in Canada. Workers were building a cantilever bridge over the St. Lawrence River. This was not an easy task. The river was 2 miles wide at its narrowest point. The river was deep, moved quickly, and was icy in the winter. But in the late 1880s, businessmen in Quebec who wanted to keep up trade with Montreal decided the river had to be spanned. The project did not begin for more than a decade due to a lack of funds. Finally, the Canadian government supported the project to improve the nation's railway infrastructure. Theodore Cooper, a respected American bridge designer, was signed on for the project. Despite concerns about the bridge's design, he never visited the site due to illness. 86 men were working on the project that fateful day. Their workday was drawing to a close when the bridge suddenly collapsed. 75 men plunged to their deaths. Some of their bodies were never found. The bridge collapsed because of design flaws. The official report of the disaster noted that the loss of life, quote, might have been prevented by the exercise of better judgment on the part of those in responsible charge of the work for the Quebec Bridge and Railway Company and the Phoenix Bridge Company. Unfortunately, it was not the last tragedy trying to cross the St. Lawrence. After the bridge collapsed, the Canadian government took over the project. A partial collapse on that effort killed 13 more workers in 1916. The bridge finally opened in 1917. Its completion came at a high price, costing $22 million and 86 lives. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
The people are revolting in the very best meaning of that word. An inspiring example of people rising up against a trifecta of economic, cultural, and political oppression has just come to us from a community of seemingly powerless people living in a very isolated place. Long exploited, lied to, disrespected, and robbed, they revolted, daring to take on the biggest, richest, most politically connected industrial power on the globe, Big Oil. Astonishingly, after a decade of protesting, organizing, coalition building, suing, petitioning, and otherwise resolutely rebelling against injustice, these tenacious people just won an inspiring grassroots victory over big oil profiteering. One reason you probably haven't heard about it is that it didn't happen in any of the usual centers of media focus, but in the Amazonian rainforest of Ecuador. Also, this revolt was not led by some brand-name environmental group or charismatic political honcho, but by the Tagere and Taro-Manani tribes and other indigenous Warani people living in the rich biodiversity of Ecuador's Yosemite National Park. Directly challenging the exigent crisis of climate change, the Warani rallied the region's young people into a potent political force. They successfully organized behind a national referendum to 1. Ban oil drilling in the region, 2, compel the profiteers to remove their wells and pipelines, and 3, pay for remediation and reforestation. Significantly, they specifically called for leaving oil in the ground so it would not add to climate destruction. And the proposed ban was binding, unable to be overturned by future lobbyists and officials. This is Jim Hightower saying, a resounding 58% of Ecuadorians said yes. As a Warani leader noted, this is the day the planet started to win.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So look, as I've been talking about, you know, pretty much all the last couple of days, this decision by the National Labor Relations Board is a big deal. To get people organized, better wages, hours, conditions being a huge part of that. And for me, safety on the job is paramount. And what we know, and look, you know, the Biden folks came out, Kamala Harris and the Treasury Secretary had their big task force report pointing out that union members make 15% more in an industry that unions are involved in, with better health care, better retirement, all the sweeteners. But I would also argue safer. Union environment, safer. Because you have the opportunity to say, no, I'm not going to do dumb things. No, I'm not going to put myself in danger. And as someone who's driven a truck and worked in the freight industry for over 30 years, I'll be the first to tell you, I've never taken an unsafe truck on the road because I've had the ability to say, no, brakes are an adjustment, fix them. That is empowering. And here to share some thoughts on, this latest decision, could this help make workplaces safer? That's why I've asked our good friend Jordan Barab to come talk with us. Jordan is a former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA. During the Obama years, he also does the Confined Spaces blog, which is, I'm not going to say it's great. I'm not going to say it's incredible because it's deadly. It talks about all the people who lost their lives. So I don't want to put it up, but it's a really useful resource. And that's why I've asked Jordan to come talk with us. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here, Rick.
So let's start with this. I make the argument, we got 35% union density in this country, like my grandparents had. We got safer workplaces. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that being in a union workplace makes the job safer for a variety of reasons. First of all, as you say, you can exercise your rights better, and that includes exercising your rights not to do dangerous work and, if necessary, to refuse to do dangerous work. Even before that, if you're in a union, you're much more likely to be educated about the hazards that you're facing. You're much more likely to be educated about the rights you have under the law. And again, you're much more able to use those rights without fear of retaliation. And that's the main thing, because, that's why workers don't speak up enough, especially vulnerable workers, immigrant workers, low paid workers who can't afford to lose their job. I mean, they're afraid they're going to be retaliated against. Unfortunately, the law isn't all that strong. I mean, the Occupational Safety and Health Act has anti-retaliation language, but it's not very strong, and the law is 50 years old and not really up to date in terms of protections. So the best protections you can possibly have, to use your health and safety rights without being retaliated against, is to belong to a union.
Yeah, and this is why I think this is a big deal, what the Biden administration is doing. In fact, I think what Biden has been doing and this administration on a lot of fronts, the fact that we're talking about heat-related accidents and illnesses, I think that's a huge step in the right direction, finally. But there's a lot of this stuff that I think, that he's on the right side of.
Yeah. I mean, just today, for example, the Biden administration, OSHA, issued a proposal for a regulation that will enable non-union workers to choose their own walk-around representatives. I mean, right now, workers, when they call OSHA, they have a right to name their walk-around representative. But actually, that only mostly applies if you're in a union. And if you're not, and there's no walk-around representative, then OSHA is just supposed to talk to workers. But when we were there during the Obama administration, we had a lot of workers who were, working with industrial hygienists independently or working with worker rights groups, and they weren't organized. Or sometimes they were in the process of an organizing campaign. They called OSHA and they wanted to, they wanted that workers' right group, or they wanted the union that was helping them organize to be their walk-around representatives. during the Obama administration, we basically clarified that rule to say, yeah, you can do that. Workers, even if they're non-union, can elect their own walk-around representatives when OSHA comes to inspect. That we faced incredible Republican resistance, business resistance, Congress. We eventually had to go back, withdraw it. And then it got killed during the Obama administration. During the Trump administration. And now the Biden administration is going through the full regulatory process, which will make it more or less permanent that every worker, even those, that aren't in a union, can choose their walk-around representatives when OSHA comes to inspect.
And why is that a big deal? Why is that important?
Well, it's important because nobody knows the workplace better than workers. Nobody knows the hazards better than workers. And especially if the workers are the ones that file the complaint, they want to be able to show OSHA exactly what's happening and how that workplace normally works. I mean, you find all kinds of, situations where OSHA will go to a workplace to look at a certain process and, oh my God, the process is shut down. Well, can somebody tell me, how this works? And, nobody's there to tell them except for, the manager about, how things supposedly work. But if you're protected and you have, the walk-around representative, you can walk around with the OSHA representative, with the OSHA inspector, and let him or her know exactly what's going on, where the hazards are, where the close calls have been, where the dangerous equipment have been, because, OSHA does not, OSHA inspectors don't know every piece of equipment and how every piece of equipment works. They need the workers there to help them, with the inspection. And the walk-around representation is what helps them do that. And now, instead of just being union workers, every worker will have that right to choose their own walk-around representatives.
No, that's a big deal. But for me, this is another one of those moments where this is the reason that you join a union, so that this is another one of those little things that, you can't fit on the palm card on why you join a union, but it's another one of those things that you go, yeah, this is why.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And we have, the Occupational Safety and Health Act was passed 50 years ago. Look at the United States 50 years ago. We had, union density was at its peak. Most of the economy was run by manufacturing and construction. And now 50 years later, we have much less union density. Manufacturing, the service sector has really taken over the economy. It's a very different, world out there in the American economy than it was 50 years ago. And OSHA, what we were trying to do during the Obama administration, what they're trying to do now, during the Trump administration is really bring this 50-year-old law into the 21st century, which is why you have this regulation now.
What they're trying to do in the Biden administration.
Yeah, the Biden administration.
What they tried to kill during the Trump years. Because this is one of those things when people say to me, Jordan, both parties are the same. Doesn't matter. They're all corrupt. This is one of those areas where there are stark differences.
Yeah, night and day. I mean, not just OSHA, but wage and hour, NLRB. I mean, everywhere you look, it's very different than these very Republicans in general, but especially the Trump administration.
Because we don't hear about, outside of your blog, you don't hear about workers being killed at work. It's not on the evening news. It doesn't get, any headline space above the fold on the New York Times. These are just people who are, nameless, faceless, and moved along. There doesn't seem to be that kind of, there's a problem, but there is. I think you point out there's, 100 people a week?
Yeah, basically 100 people a week are killed in the workplace. That doesn't count. Many times more die of workplace disease. It doesn't get counted as well. But, just in terms of workplace incidents, falling off ladders, getting crushed in machinery, but there are about 100 workers that die every week. And you're right, you don't hear about them. And the reason why is very simple. They die basically one at a time. And, maybe it makes the local newspaper, maybe not. Now I do a list every week. It's called the Weekly Toll of every incident I can find where a worker is killed on the job. I have 100 Google searches out there, looking at every newspaper in the country, all kinds of different search terms. The sad thing is, there are so many of these. And if you read it, it's really crushing every week to look at all the different ways workers die and all the workers that die in this workplace. The other upsetting thing is I only usually identify about 25 every week. So there's another 75 out there that I can't find, or they don't make the newspapers, and nobody ever hears about them. Nobody hears their names. Nobody hears why they died. Nobody learns any lessons from their deaths. They just kind of disappear. It's just kind of one of those things that nobody notices except their family or their friends or their coworkers.
Isn't this something that I would argue that OSHA should be compiling and putting out? Isn't this something that should be available, data that's being collected so that it can be used, so that we can learn lessons? Because I'm of the mindset that virtually every death is preventable.
Yeah, pretty much. And OSHA, I'm not sure if they still do. I know they had a they had a running line on their website about, you know, fatal workplace injuries that ran across the top of the website. I'm not sure if that's still there or not. We started that, and then the Trump administration took it down. And then the Biden administration put it back up again. You know, they don't want to know. They don't want, you know, they don't want people to know that workers are dying every day on the job. So, you know, if they can hide it, you know, then nobody gets concerned about it and nobody knows about it.
Yeah, but yeah,
actually, if you look on the OSHA website, there's a section that says remembering lost workers, and it has workers' names on there. And if you click on it, it does provide some kind of summary of it. Now, these are, you know, these are dated, obviously. They aren't quite totally up to date. And OSHA also does a list. They require employers to report, you know, to OSHA every fatality, every hospitalization, and every loss of an eye, every amputation. And those are published on OSHA's website. Unfortunately, you know, OSHA's not too well funded, so it usually takes about 6 months for that data to actually come up on the website. But it is there, at least.
And that's a problem. I mean, you know, I saw a statistic. It would take, like, 150 years to inspect every workplace in the country at the current level of inspectors that we have.
It's actually up to about 190 years now, every 190 years.
I was being generous. that's just even worse. And it's more than just people dying on the job. It's all of the injuries. It's all of the long-term suffering. It's all of the stuff that comes with that. And this, you know, as we move into this next era of robotics and this next era of you know, being, you know, tracked and data points on every step we take, mental health has got to play into some of this as well, I think.
Yeah, probably. And that's something OSHA has a hard time dealing with. I mean, mental health, stress issues, mental health issues that are caused by the workplace. You know, any kind of health issue OSHA has a hard time with. They do have some standards. Problem is with a lot of health effects, you know, they're hard to track to the workplace. And sometimes they don't, you know, affect people. I mean, especially if you're looking at chemicals or mental health issues, they may not have an effect, you know, until many years after the job, after you finish the job. I mean, they may mostly have an effect when you're home instead of at the workplace. It's very difficult to kind of track that kind of thing. I mean, there's certainly been studies on it, but the law doesn't really, you know, allow OSHA to deal with that kind of stuff very, very well.
And it shows how far behind our laws actually are, because, you know, just a minute ago, we were talking about Amazon drivers. And there's a lot of workers that are tracked with every step they take. Got the handheld thing that is thing on your wrist telling you what to do every 10 seconds. You're gauging how many boxes you pick up. You got the camera staring you in the face, you know, tracking everything. So every minute of your life is being scrutinized. And I'm concerned that down the road, as this continues, and I think it's only going to get worse, because we're clearly not, without a strong union environment to push back, we're clearly not capable of pushing back on this. I'm concerned that, you know, mental health being a big part of this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But you see, I mean, you know, these are the problems. A lot of these problems that you just talked about with the drivers are problems that UPS drivers had, and some of them they were able to address during their recent negotiations and the threatened strike that they won a great contract, and it did deal with some of those issues, like the cameras, for example.
Yeah. Now, in looking at this, and I, like I said, on Monday, you had the administration come out and say, hey, look, you know, there's all these better benefits, all this better stuff of being a union member. Friday, you had the decision coming out of the NLRB kind of moving in the direction to get people to join and form unions. Do you have hope that maybe we're going to go in that direction and maybe we can address some of these things?
Yeah, I always have hope, especially if we don't have to go back into the Trump era again. But yeah, I think, you know, if we get 4 years or, you know, hopefully more than that of a Democratic administration that's, you know, pro-union, pro-worker administration, and hopefully we can, you know, take back the House and increase our margins in there. Because the other thing is, I mean, you know, it's great we have a good president that's really supportive of labor, but you've got a Congress now that's essentially trying to defund OSHA. I mean, the House budget, the proposed House budget, called for a 15% cut in OSHA's budget. I mean, OSHA is already an incredibly small, understaffed, under-resourced agencies. And, you know, to think that, you know, they would propose to cut that further by 15% is just incredible. It would be disastrous.
But I listen to my Republican friends, Jordan, and they're telling me that, you know, it's those rogue agencies like OSHA who's, you know, job killers, Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the problem is, you know, the Republican budgets are worker killers. You know, there's no evidence that OSHA kills jobs or regulations kill jobs. In fact, to the contrary, because regulations actually, you know, make businesses run more efficiently and more safely,
and save lives. I think we're headed in a good direction, the right direction. I give this administration credit for at least going that. Anything that you would change, anything that you would do in addition to this to help make this better, with all your years of expertise, there's got to be something.
Yeah, well, there's a lot. Again, as I said, the Occupational Safety and Health Act is 50 years old. It was, you know, built for an era where there were unions. It really needs rewriting and revamping. And we you know, it can take 10 or 20 years to issue an OSHA standard these days. That's just unacceptable and not at all what was intended when the law was passed. You know, Congress can pass laws that direct OSHA to issue standards much faster, but obviously that's not going to happen when we have, you know, Republican majorities in either House of Congress or, God forbid, a Republican president. So there is a lot Congress can do, you know, if we have big enough majorities, and obviously have to deal with the filibuster in the Senate. Funding being the first one, but also just changing the law. And there have been proposals to change the law in a number of different areas that would make OSHA much more effective and protect more workers much better.
Again, these are the issues that we should be voting on. I don't care who wears a dress. I don't care who does what with who in their bedroom. This is the stuff we should be voting on. At least that's my thoughts. But Jordan, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Always great having you on.
All right, you're welcome. Anytime.
Our good friend Jordan Barrett. Make sure you check out his website, jordanbarrett.com/confinedspace. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. We'll take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1996. That was the day the workers at the Lusty Lady Strip Club in San Francisco made their final push to make their case for the right to join a union. They made history by winning the union vote 57-15. SEIU Local 790 led the historic campaign. What started the union drive was the windows at the private booths where the ladies performed. The windows had one-way glass. That meant patrons could look in, but performers could not see out. They worried that the men could videotape them or take photographs without their permission. When management refused to change the windows, the women started talking union. Soon, other workplace issues arose as the women furthered their union discussion. One woman recalled, "We started to discuss other problems at work, like being forced to come in when you were sick." She went on, "Our first thought was to organize a petition, but we were really concerned about individual dancers being scapegoated and fired because that happened on a regular basis." Another participant in the union drew on her personal background as a reason for getting involved. She noted, "I had been raised to support union efforts and the workers' cause. I hadn't ever worked at a place where there was any sort of struggle to be a part of." The women ran a successful campaign to unionize. Despite winning the vote, management dragged its feet in negotiating their first contract. The women went on strike and management locked them out. Few men dared to cross the picket line to enter the club. And within a few days, management capitulated and returned to the bargaining table where the women signed their first contract. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. TheRickSmithShow.com. Interesting article over at the Washington Post. And, you know, this is one of those file under the dumbing down of America. I've talked years about the whole homeschooling movement. And my position has always been homeschooling is child abuse. It's that simple in my view. Because you're handcuffing your children into your narrow-minded viewpoints. And look, most of the people I know who do the homeschooling stuff, it's about religion or it's about their narrow-minded ideology, generally religion. So am I surprised that the very well-to-do person that they pointed out in this article, who's the guy behind this recent massive push towards homeschooling is a guy who's, you know, an old blast from the past. And they point out this guy, Michael Ferris, who is a conservative Christian lawyer who, you know, made his name suing, you know, for homeschooling back in the 80s and even worse. For years was just kind of a fringe character. And, you know, the whole homeschooling thing was kind of a fringe thing. And, you know, when the TV show with the 18, 19, 50 and counting, whatever it is, that kind of brought to the forefront this push. And I've been saying for years what the Christian community wants, the Quiverful movement in particular, what they want is they want to be able to pump out as many kids as they can. Like the 19 and 20 or 20 counting kid people, and then homeschool them and have the government pay them. And I've said that's always been the goal. It's always been the goal to make education dollars portable, put it in a backpack wherever the kids go, it goes with them. And everyone would say, well, it's about charter schools, it's about magnet, it's about all this other stuff. I'm just saying, I've said, no, it's never been about that. It's always been about cashing in on the taxpayers' back for these groups. Well, what this Washington Post article has pointed out is, yeah, congratulations. This guy, you know, on a call of a bunch of rich, crazy right-wing conservatives, made the pitch. Time to take down public education. Time to push them on, you know, on... It's about race. It's about gender. It's about all these things other than what it actually is. And look, they've been masterful at pitching this idea that public education harms your kids and that parents are somehow, you know, divinely entitled, divinely empowered to be the great educators. Now, what's interesting to me is most of the people I know who do the homeschooling barely got out of high school themselves. So to put the next generation's mind, their ability to learn and think critically in the hands of people who could barely get through a system themselves, not good, not good for a country. And I think it leads us to the point that we're at in a lot of spaces where you've got this confirmation bias, where if you don't believe what I believe, absolutely, well, you can thank the Supreme Court, a decision that gave parental rights groups the ability to claim billions of dollars in tax dollars for private education and homeschooling. This is going to get bigger. But this article, you know, talks about, you know, the push behind this and the issues that they're pushing. You know, critical race theory didn't just come out of nowhere. There was a moneyed group who said, hey, let's message this. They organized parents to get all riled up and to fear people into action, because nothing motivates like scaring the heck out of people. They're coming for your children, which is why all these Q kooks are on the, oh, we've got to stop child trafficking. And how are we going to do that? We're going to go on Facebook and we're going to post mean things about Joe Biden. That's going to stop it. Or we're going to buy a ticket to a stupid movie. Oh, yeah, that's going to stop it. How about using government, you know, law enforcement? How about, no, can't do that. And this is because it's not about doing anything. It's about causing the anger. And this is where I started today. It's about causing that outrage. It's about causing people to get so irrationally angry that nothing gets done and that you just destroy things. And this guy, this Ferris guy, you know, basically came out and said, look, it's time to take down the education system as we know it. Destroy public education. You can make it a commodity so you can charge those poor people. And hey, if they can't afford it, we always need hand laborers. It's really kind of a scary thing. And his pitch has always been, you know, public schools are indoctrinating children. Godless religion. And look, you go back to the Reagan years. We've been having this prayer in school argument for years. And look, I'm not against people praying. I think you know, there are a lot worse things you can do. But I grew up believing that you did that in private. You didn't stand up in the middle of a restaurant and make a scene. You didn't go out in front of the flagpole and have a whole bunch of people standing around and causing a scene. All of this stuff is about creating tension.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic Media.